This is Marcella. Thank you for listening to Traversing the Stars podcast.
Hello, Mr. Chalk. Thank you so much for coming to Traversing the Stars podcast. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
So it's totally a pleasure to talk with you, sir. So I always start off with the question of inspiration. So what inspired your love for acting, and who were your earliest influences?
Okay. My love for acting, where did I get my inspiration? Well, I used to watch... The very first movie I ever saw, for the whole movie that I remember and loved, was, believe it or not, The Crimson Pirate with Burt Lancaster.
I've never heard of it.
Oh, it's an amazing show. It's so funny. And it's like if they took, the Pirates of the Caribbean, just imagine Pirates of the Caribbean, but in 1958.
That sounds awesome.
Without all the special effects, but there's a lot of, like, Burt Lancaster was an aerialist, right? A trapeze artist. So he did, there's a lot of stunts in there that he did himself that are pretty incredible.
Mm.
Like sliding down the sail with a knife.
Oh, really? That sounds cool.
Oh, yeah. I just loved it. That was one of my favorite all-time movies back then when I was a kid. And I saw that and I said, that's what I want to do. And I got the bug, like the entertainment bug or the performing bug, when I was just in elementary school, of all things. I did a play of A Shoemaker and the Elves. We just did it for fun in the school, but I played the shoemaker and I just loved it. And I thought, this is what I want to do, because it was fun. And then I was a singer as well. So I sang in the choir and I got on TV and I was totally enraptured by television and the way the process worked with all the giant cameras and the lights and everybody getting made up and putting on these costumes and stuff. I thought it was just the most amazing thing. And I never did it because I never dreamed that you would get paid for doing this because it's so much fun.
Right.
But people do. And I never really did it. I stayed singing and I performed in musicals at school, but I always loved it. But I never thought it was going to be a money-making venture. I never knew that movie stars made millions of dollars, but then I found out that they did. And I found out that you can actually get paid for having fun. And so that drove me. And I think what initially inspired me more than anything was I was working in various jobs. I was a bouncer in beer parlors. And I was I worked at Westinghouse building circuit breaker boards. And I worked in the stock market and worked as a social worker or emergency services worker for a couple of years. And then I went back to school because I wanted to teach English and English lit and anthropology, because I love anthropology. I'm mad for it, especially physical anthropology, like forensic anthropology.
Yeah.
I just love it. You take a bone and you go, oh, it's a male. It's 40. They eat chicken. And you can do that. You can actually do that with skeletons. There's so much information. So, and I was excelling at it. I did very well in university when I went back to university to do that. But then for one of my projects in the English class, I had to go down and watch a play and then do a play. And so I went down and I watched a play of Mice and Men at Studio 58 at the college where I went. Wow. The production value was amazing. The acting was incredible. The whole thing about it was just so well done. And I just went, that's what I want to do. And I went and did them. What clinched it was the play that I did for a end of school project, which was a production of a play called, what was it called? What the Butler Saw. And it was a Joe Orton play, and it was just incredible. And I had so much fun, and people laughed and had these great times. And so that sealed it. Then I joined up with the school, and I've been acting ever since. And I graduated in 1970, 78. In 1978, I graduated.
You know, that's what's so awesome about your story is that my bachelor's degree is anthropology.
Is it?
Yeah, it is. I actually did focus on primatology, and I've been doing, and I did that for about 3 or 4 years. And then I moved into, I'm now a high school English teacher. So it was really funny listening to you talk. I was like, oh my God, that's my life.
That's your life. Ah! Yeah. Well, you know, my big thing was in cultural anthropology, I did my paper on the effect of the fur trade on Plains Indians.
Oh,
on
wow.
A Blackfeet Crow and the Glacian, or the Blackfoot Bloods and Glacians, the Prairie Cree, who were forced to become fur traders and ranchers when they were hunter gatherers. They went after the buffalo and the effect that it had on their culture, forcing them into doing this, as well as trying to erase their culture. So it was quite an eye opener.
That's awesome. I'm gonna nerd out on that all day. That's awesome.
Oh yeah, no, and in the physical anthropology, I made a comparison between. Actually, it was quite a bit of ahead of its time, if I do say so myself, because I wrote a paper and it was the effect of environment on. Single male hamadryas baboons.
Oh.
And it was a weird thing because when food and water is plentiful, then baboons would gather in groups as large as 1,000.
Oh, wow.
And there would be, rampant, everybody's, lack of a better word, everybody's screwing everybody else. And it's just fun and frolic, plenty of food, plenty of water. Oh, yeah, let's have a party. And that's what they did. But as food and water became more and more scarce, the groups would shrink to one male, couple of females, and a couple of juveniles, and that was it. And the male was always aggressive with the female, with the females in the troop, and any other guy or any other male came in there, there'd be vicious fights. So keep the group small. And it was because the environment basically forced them into being isolated. And I sort of made a correlation between that and how stressors are present in today's world. When you look at today's world with all the conflicts, and that time was Vietnam, and there was all these other things going on. And you look around and you go, wow, that's happening today. I mean, you've got increased in population, but people are becoming more and more insular because of the war and the war in Russia and the Middle East, and they're all becoming tighter and tighter and tighter. And it's like we're subject as animals, and because we are animals, we're subject to the same sort of environmental cues as other animals are, but we're not aware of it, as just like they're not aware of it because they're subconscious, because no one just says, you know what I'm going to do today? I'm going to go kill 50 people just for fun. And then I'm going to kill myself. Who does that?
Right, right.
What drives you to do that? And the same thing with wars. I'm going to start a war today and I'm going to kill 200,000 people. What a great idea. Why would anybody think that's a great idea? But there are these subconscious cues. And so I just think that environmental pressure has a big thing to do with it. But we're digressing but we can talk about this.
Well, today. I know, I was thinking to myself, so taking your idea, right, and extrapolating it going forward, as populations increase more and resources become less, what would you predict in the future then, based on that theory?
Well, what would happen is eventually that, aggression would take over from common sense. And we would basically, this is sort of a pessimistic view, don't get me wrong, but nature abhors imbalance.
Mm.
And nature will always find a way to achieve balance. And right now we're at a bit of an imbalance. because resources, we're competing for resources with every other creature on the planet.
Right.
And
right.
And at some point, like this COVID thing, I mean, it only wiped out 12 million people. I mean, it's not a big deal, but it's balance.
Right. I can totally geek out with you this all day long. I remember when I was in college, I wrote a play. There's an anthropologist, I would get the first name, I think Emil Durkheim. And I had a whole play set up where he was arguing at a seminar against all the other classic anthropologists in history. And they're having a debate with one another. And it was, I think it went on for 12 or 20 pages, but it was really, and I remember, and I had the class acted out and everything. It was pretty cool.
Well, I can imagine. I mean, when you look at some of the things, like, you know, what was that book? The Territorial Imperative. You remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
And everybody debunked that. But, well, let's just have a look around now.
Right, exactly.
That's not true. Not true. Well, but, you know, that's a whole other kettle of fish.
We're going to have a separate interview of just talking anthropology in English.
Oh, yeah. If you want to read something really interesting, there's a real radical book called Call Me Ishmael.
I've read it.
I
read it. Call me that one. Then there's Ishmael, and then Story of B. I read that one as well.
Yeah, that's the other one too.
Those are fascinating.
They are. They really are. When you look at them, you go, "Wow, this is so hardcore," but it kind of made sense.
it did. I think the only issue I ever had was that the recommendation, I think it was in Story of B, is that somehow we can get people to go backwards and become less technical in our life. I was like, you can't slow down the train, though. So I was like, I agree with almost all the concepts, but I don't think you can slow down the train and make people ever revert backwards.
No, because we're used to doing things at a certain speed.
Yeah,
we're used to having things at hand. You know, what used to take a lifetime to do, like, I mean, you think of something like building the Gaudi Church.
Yeah,
you know, in Barcelona, they've been building that thing for centuries, and it's still not finished.
Right.
But, you know, all those old cathedrals, they took, not, you'd think, oh yeah, that took 10 years to build. No, 200 and 300 years to build these things. Right.
Exactly.
So I can't imagine anyone wanting to go back to that.
I agree 100%. Like I said, I will say the books were fast. There's three of them. I know there's Ishmael. Was it My Ishmael? And then I think there's Story and Story of B. And they were all were fascinating. They're great reads. A little heavy, but they were fantastic in how he presents it. And was it The Talking Gorilla? It was awesome.
Looking for someone to save the world. For that, he's in the cage in his office. Yeah.
Right.
He takes an ad out. I'm looking for an assistant who wants to save the world.
Right.
And he shows up in the office of Talking Gorilla. Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm in.
You know, I could totally see you doing the audiobook for those books.
I would love to do that audiobook. But we don't do audiobooks out here. We only do them in Toronto and New York.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that sucks. That doesn't make any sense. That's unfortunate.
Well, that's where all the, what do you call them? Publishers are. Anyway.
So transitioning a little bit to your voice work. So you have voiced numerous characters from famous animated series like Transformers Beast Wars, New Adventures of He-Man, Sonic the Hedgehog. So how's your approach to voice acting similar or different to your live action performances?
Well, there's some fundamental differences. A, you're playing in animation, you're playing a fantastical character in a fantastical world. But in that world, that character is real, right? So you have to play all the emotions and everything that go with that character like it was a real character. But on the other side of it, you look at the physicality of the character. See, fat, thin, tall, big, hairy, monster, big teeth, you know, that kind of thing. You have to take all these things into account. You can't just fake them, right? Like in film, they see your face.
Yeah.
In acting, in animation, they don't see anything. You have to fill in all the blanks. That includes the uh, the physicality of the character, and the one thing I always found about animation is find out how that character laughs. As soon as you find the laugh, you have a pretty good idea what the character is all about, and a lot of times that was true. You know, we could find them in live action. Live action is very technical and at the same time very organic, in that you you know, you have to make sure that you're in the light, you have to hit your mark, you have to be conscious of where your eye line and everything is, and then at the same time you have to have be on from 7 o'clock in the morning till 7 o'clock at night. And it's got to be just as fresh from the first to the last. So you've got to really dig deep and find the characters, because the character, the camera never lies. That's the whole thing. The camera will pick up everything. And when your face is 40 feet across or 20 feet across, every little lie that you tell will be seen on that screen. So you have to be that character. And I mean, it sounds so funny. Be the character. Well, but you have to be real and natural. And because as soon as you look studied or read, you're done. You know, nobody cares about you. I mean, when you watch a movie with some really bad acting in it, and there's a few of those, just look at some of those martial arts ninja movies from you know, the American ones, the American ninja movies from in the Philippines, and some of the acting in them is really terrible. You know? And the reason why, because you don't believe them. You know, when you see a bad performance, you look at them and you go, "You lying." And as soon as you do that, you don't care about them anymore. So you really have to, it doesn't matter what you're playing, if you're playing a villain or a good guy, you know, no villain believes they're a bad guy. You know, they always think they're good guys. And you can't think of a good guy being a bad guy, but a good guy can be a bad guy at times. It's you just because you're in the moment, because no one is, you know, universally good or universally bad. They all have their moments, and that's what makes characters interesting. That's why I love playing villains, but I never get a chance to play them. But I have played them a few times, and it's really fun. So that's a nutshell.
Well, you play one of my favorite characters in all of animation, Marsala, and I loved ExoSquad growing up. I used to watch it right before I went to school. Mm-hmm. And well, for people who don't know ExoSquad, and you should look it up, it's on Peacock. Marsala's a Neo-Sapien. So how did you get involved with the series, and what were you told about Marsala upon earning the role?
Well, the thing about that show is I auditioned for it years ago. I mean, we're talking like almost 30 years ago. We auditioned for that. And I always saw Marsala as kind of he was kind of one of those, a spiritual kind of guy. You know, he had that ethereal quality about him. He never really got angry or sad. At most times, he was thoughtful, and it was that thoughtfulness, that serenity, that island of calm, as compared to that other character. Ooh, what was it? I can't remember.
Phaeton. Phaeton.
Phaeton. Yes, totally different character, which I loved. But and so I got the part, and I loved the writing in the show. I loved the storylines and the art, and I thought, you know, why didn't we get that revived? It was such a beautiful show. And the characters in it, they were incredible. And I saw that it showed up somewhere. I think I saw a clip on YouTube. And a friend of mine called me from Israel that it was playing in Israel. And they love it there. So I was hoping that they would revive that that show, because I mean, even with today's animation, wow, it would be pretty amazing. Just take the tracks and reanimate it.
Well, you know? the one thing about Exo Squad that I realized, because I've gone back and I rewatched it a few times, is that I honestly think it was too smart for when it came out. It's like it was, because yeah. I think adults can understand Exo Squad better than kids did, but adults didn't think about animation back then, and it was being marketed to children when it was the adults who would have better understood the show.
Well, I think, you know, I think I would mildly disagree with you. I think it was targeted towards adults because it was an adult, it had adult-oriented themes, and it had the complexities of things like loyalty and morality and things like that. That, you know, I mean, if even for tweeners, or, you know, for teenagers and things like that, and then into early adults. But I've known a lot of adult people who watch that show and just love it.
Well,
but I don't know if kids would understand the nuance.
Oh, what I meant by marketing was that because the show was being aired towards kids Saturday morning or weekday morning watching, it wasn't being sent for adults. You know, it wasn't put in a prime time slot where an adult would have the ability or see it or witness it.
Yeah.
Instead, it was being aired for towards children times. Like I said, when kids were watching it, and I don't think, like you said, kids, I don't think could get the complexity of these characters, which is very deep. I mean, there's issues of racism. There's issues of, you know, just how this prejudice can affect her. I mean, it's so many levels to it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was an incredible show that way. And I think the other thing, too, was at that time, I just got a call from Riverdale. At that time, it was more about toy placement, right?
Mm.
And they had great toys, the exoskeletons and all that. They were amazing toys. And there was, and that's what they were always trying to do, is market action figures. The only unfortunate part is the stories were really good.
Right. I mean, I thought they were fantastic. One thing that was kind of interesting is that, once again, talking about Phaeton versus Marsala, is that they're both broodmates. They physically look very much the same. They were, the way they are, because for people who don't know watching the show, the Neo Sapiens are manufactured beings, humans. So, being with the idea that they weren't going to be so different from one another because they're being built for work. So, when you're portraying Marsala, did you and the actors from Phaeton and everyone else discuss how you were going to make these characters seem like a similar entity?
No, because like machines, all machines have different purposes and different works. And sometimes there are anomalous mistakes made. Mm. And I think Phaeton was one of them. Or could have been Marsala. You know, Marsala should have been, you know, it could have been a vicious killer, but he wasn't. He was quite spiritual. I quite loved that. It was one of my favorite characters.
Marsala is one of the few Neo Sapiens that stayed working with the humans throughout the series. Mm. Was there a discussion when you're formulating the character to explain what was about him that felt to stay and loyal to the humans instead of staying with his own Neo Sapien people?
Well, I don't know. I think that like any sentient being, they form affections. They form alliances that when you look at it, you go, how the hell did that happen? You see that in real life, where, you know, things like, what's her face, the cooking book, the cookbook gal, you know,
Martha Stewart?
Martha Stewart and Snoop Dogg.
Right.
I mean, you got Snoop Dogg and Martha Stewart. They're great pals. They get along. And how on earth Snoop Dogg comes from this world and Martha Stewart comes from this world that's just kind of diametrically opposed, yet somehow they find this attraction and chemistry that work so fine. And I think the same thing applies to, well, it doesn't matter if they're manufactured. If you're sentient, you have the potential to be an enemy or an ally. And that's what happened with Marcella, is he became an ally.
Do you think that if Marcella, things went a different way with Marcella and he didn't connect, make those connections with Exo Squad, do you think he would have ever been on Phaeton's side?
It's hard to say because again, you're talking about the like a malleability of a character. He could be manipulated into following in Phaeton's footsteps. But I personally think that it wasn't in his DNA, manufactured or not.
So what was, when you're playing Marcella, what was it about that character that captured your thoughts? Was it the spirituality? Was it the moral complexity of what he was doing?
I think what drew me to Marcella was, A, he was manufactured. So I had to come up with something with that. And B, his life was very complicated. All the things that he had to do, and the decisions he had to make, and just his thought process were very complicated. And they worked on a lot of levels, a lot of nuance, and that would, to me, was fascinating. It was way weirder. Which way did he go? Which way did he go? You know, I mean, there's a difference. There's just like this madcap craziness, and then there's this thoughtfulness which required me to, you know, to really, you know, bring my A game, as it were. And that's one of the things that I thought was amazing and very challenging for me.
When you were performing for Marcella, were you in the same room with all the other actors, or were you set with the recorders? They were together?
Oh, yeah. With all our cartoons up until COVID, all our cartoon recording is ensemble play. It's the only way to go. I mean, When you're working in a situation like that where relationships and nuance really matters, you know, you can't just sit there and give me the line three different ways and hopefully we'll hit it right.
Right.
You know, because you're talking back and forth. And while you're talking back and forth, you find those moments, right? The moments hit you and you go, oh, because, you know, when you get into it, it's acting is not so much about acting. It's all about reacting. Right? So you react to a response, you know, or someone reacts to your response to them, and backwards and forwards. It's like playing tennis, you know, you're throwing the ball back and forth. And it's hard to do when there's nobody in the room, because it's like you're hitting the ball over the net, nothing's coming back. You don't know if you want the lob or a line drive, you know. It's that way. So, but I've gotten used to it in the last couple of years since COVID, because now all the cartoons I do are basically in the studio by myself. But hopefully that will change this year. We're waiting for that. And so that's basically it. And I guess that's it. Yeah, I loved that. And I loved working in the studio with the guys. It was so much, and the girls, it was so much fun. They're a great bunch of people.
So the thing I think that drives the fans crazy about Exo Squad is that the second season ends on a cliffhanger. There's indications of a third season. There's going to be, sounds like aliens were going to be involved. Was there a discussion among the group, the cast, the writers, of what the third season was going to be?
No. We were never told anything about anything. We just knew that for whatever reason, the show wasn't picked up. And why it ended on the cliffhanger, I'll never know, because it's so frustrating, because it's like, I've seen a few shows like that where there was one show that was called Invasion. It was a sci-fi series, and it was a pretty good series.
Right.
And it ended on nothing. And then it ended on a cliffhanger, and they're going, well, where's the rest? Where'd it go? You know? That's it? It's all done? You know, I've seen that happen a few times where a show just ends and there's no rhyme or reason to it. at least with you know, with something like what a good show that just ended.
Oh, The Blacklist.
Blacklist, yeah, The Blacklist. That's still going, but I felt sure it was ending. No, it's not ending. His cancer is not gone, and I'm going. So I'm just going crazy. Anyway.
Yeah,
how it goes.
I say it's such a shame that it ends on that cliffhanger, because every time you watch the show, you want to see what was going to happen, because it felt like the Neo Sapiens and the humans were going to be working together. You sound like this great plot line, and it just stopped. I was like, someone has to finish it. Someone needs to finish this last season.
I know. Well, anyway, one day, you know, all these things will be resolved, and that's what we've always hoped, that, you know, these things will be resolved. It's like my end of life on Stargate. When I get my ship, the Croylan gets destroyed in this massive battle with the Ori, and they go, oh no, you escaped in a life pod. We're bringing you back. Really? Well, am I escaping in a life pod? We don't know. We didn't see you go into the life pod, so who knows? But then never went again. So, well, it went as a different iteration, but Stargate for SG-1, yeah. But I had a glorious death.
So, what is it like to be part of so many shows that have such deep fan base? Exo Squad has a deep fan base. Stargate, He-Man, Transformers, these all have huge dedicated fan base. What is it like to be embraced by those fans and being part of those worlds?
Well, I'll tell you, it's actually quite wonderful. You know, I have so much with these guys. I mean, you know, I get all my, like, my photos and things like that. The only one I don't have a photo of is Exo Squad, because I can't find a decent enough print.
Oh, wow.
But I love him. I just was over in England last month for a convention in Birmingham, and the fans there were marvelous. They were just great. I they were so happy that, because they haven't seen me. Well, I haven't been there for about 10 years. And they were just over the moon, and it was just wonderful. And then in Baltimore, it was crazy. I was in Baltimore last October, and they were just like, holy moly. But I like it. They're wonderful fans, and if it weren't for them, I wouldn't be here.
Well, you got to stop by Rhode Island Comic Con, Terrific Con, or Boston Comic Con sometime in the future, because that's where I am. So you got to go to one of those shows now.
If we're in Baltimore, nowhere.
Rhode Island Comic Con or Terrific Con, you should stop by, because those are the ones I go to. So,
wow, I've never been to Rhode Island. Well, maybe they'll give me a Rhode Island call one day. I don't do many. I've got to be quite honest. I don't do a lot of conventions. I might be able to do more, in the following years. But I was working so much in movies and animation. I'm working like almost 7 days a week.
Hmm.
At one time, and I never had any time. I mean, there was one thing I hated worse is saying, "Oh yeah, I'd love to do a convention," and then 2 or 3 weeks before the convention, I get a call saying, "You are not going anywhere. You're staying here." And I said, "But I got my book to get." I don't care. You're not going anywhere. This show is worth 7 years of work. So, excuse me. So that's when I got a series that lasted a long time, and I did 2 or 3 television series that lasted a while, and so it made it very difficult to get away for those weekend cons. But now it's a bit easier, because I don't do as much work these days as I used to. I used to work 150 days a year, you know, and sometimes 100 days a year, and you know, and it was, you know, I never took a holiday for 10 years. my last vacation, like full vacation that I took, which turned out to be a working vacation, was I went to Australia with my wife, and I ended up doing a convention in Brisbane and Adelaide, and my wife was doing seminars for her company in Canberra, Brisbane, Sydney, and Adelaide. So in that 2 week honeymoon that we were supposed to be on, we actually saw each other for like 4 days. I had some conventions going. And the holiday, my last holiday before that was the year 2000. 2000? No, 2004 was my last holiday. I went to Thailand for 2 weeks and golfed for two weeks.
That's awesome.
All down the peninsula, which was just amazing. And the food was great and everything was great. And that was my first. And my wife wouldn't go. We used to go, and my ex-wife, she wouldn't go. And I said, like, come on, let's go. We'll have fun. So I just said, well, the hell with it. I'm not getting any younger. I'm going. So I picked off and rode elephants and did all that great stuff. But we used to go on a 4 day junket every once in a while. We go down to Oregon, down to Cannon Beach, is my favorite place in the world. So,
well, that is awesome. Well, you're now in a movie called Love on Fire as Don Hamilton. So what drew you to that role?
Oh, that was my friend Christy DeWolf said, come and do our movie. And I said, okay. And it was like a Parks Board official or something like that. Or I can't remember what it was. It was a city official. And my friend Tegan Moss is the star of it. And I loved her. And my friend John Cassini was in it as well. So I said, what the hell? Let's go. I'm going to go do that for a day or two. It'd be a good laugh. And we had a great time. That was a lot of fun. It's a cute little film. And Christy DeWolf is the director, was just a delight. I just love that woman. She's so great. But that's all. I mean, I do a lot of movies. And that was quite fun. And the reason why I took it is because of Christy and Tegan. Because I've been working with Tegan since she was a little kid. And now she's all grown up. I think my first show with her, she was about 9. But, I've done a few movies. Did a Reba McEntire movie this year, which was a lot of fun. We had a couple of great scenes together. And I did a movie with Josh Duhamel, which was great fun, and Kevin Dillon. And another one with Jonathan Rhys-Meyer. You know him? He played Henry VIII on Tudors, a show called Tudors.
Okay.
And he's been in lots of shows. He's an Irish actor. And we did a sort of a thriller horror movie called Disquiet. It'll be on Paramount Plus. And that was a lot of fun. I was playing this sort of a spiritual guide for him, which was kind of fun. And we had a good time. But that's it for the moment. You know, I'm just waiting. And then I don't know what's going on here. I just got a call from, let me see. What did he say here? Oh, it's just, I got a script. Yay!
So when you get the script, and you end up on this whatever movie or show, you come back and you can talk about that as well.
Yes. Oh yeah, I'll be talking about this. This show. Do you know this show, Riverdale?
Oh yes, I am very familiar with Riverdale.
Yeah. Well, it's like I'll be doing Riverdale, but I can't say anything. So don't say anything.
Well, do you want me to edit that out? That you're gonna be on Riverdale.
Yeah. I don't think I signed an NDA, but I'm not really allowed to say anything about the show or about, you know, the storyline or anything like that. So, but it's kind of a cool show, you know?
Yeah. It is based on Archie. If I remember correctly.
Dark Archie.
Right.
It's a Darchy comics. Dark Archie. Because I remember I used to read Archie and Veronica all the time when I was a kid. And they were kind of like, you know, the high school hijinks kind of thing. This one is kind of, it's sort of moody. You know, it's a very dark show. I watched it a little bit. But it's cool. Anyway, I have my few favorites that I watch right now. what's the name of that the show about the superheroes? Ellen Page or Emmett Page is
oh
in
the
it.
Umbrella Academy.
The Umbrella Academy.
Yes.
Love that.
It's a very good show.
It was a bit bizarre, but season one was excellent.
Yeah, I agree 100%.
Yeah, that was a great show. Oh, and have you seen Ark, was it called? Not Arkans, Archangel Ark. Oh God, it'll come to me. I don't know why. I think I'm suffering from Alzheimer's because there's this amazing animated show. Alchemist? No, not Alchemist. Something like that. It's a
I think you're talking about. I can feel like the listeners to the show, they're gonna be screaming at the screen, being like, "This is the name!" Like it's like Full Metal Alchemist, I think it's called.
Oh, Full Metal Alchemist is it's pretty nifty. The dubbing is not that great, but it's pretty nifty. No, I got it. It's called. Oh, come on, Gary, you dip. You know what it's called?
Is it Arcane?
The Netflix show.
Is it Arcane?
Arcane. That's
yes,
the
that
one.
That is really good. That is a really well done show.
That is just excellent. Mm. Everything about it is like art. Every frame is like art.
Yeah. You know?
And I'm surprised that all these people are Arcane. What the hell is Arcane? I said, go check it out, Jesus.
So when you're watching these shows, are you like dialing the number like, I'm going to be on that show now, you dial and be like, put me on your show. I'm going to be on the next season. I am Gary Chalk, God damn it. I want to be in the next season.
I am.
Well, Mr. Chalk, it was a total pleasure, sir. And like I said, come back anytime. It was my honor.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And have a wonderful day, my friend. Okay. See ya.